And also be aware that these are recorded since we are streaming them on YouTube. So you can always access the recordings of previous classes by simply going to kadampa-center.org and then click on the tab across the top that says recording.
Oh, okay, cool. All right.
He has his own life. He just does. Hello, Sandra. We also have Joe Miller. Karen Beasley.
Okay, so we are live streaming on YouTube now.
Okay. Well, it's almost 7 now, so maybe we can at least start. Linda, do you have any announcements before we get going?
No, I don't, but if anyone does have any questions whatsoever, feel free to put those in the chat box. And that is true whether you are joining us on Zoom or on YouTube. And I will relay those questions to Hemant. And if you have questions, just general questions for me as far as, you know, how to find Discovering Buddhism materials online, anything like that, just let me know and I'll shoot you an answer back via chat. So I will go ahead and turn it over to Hemant now. Thanks so much, everyone.
Great, thank you.
Good to see you.
Well, good evening again. This is the session 3 of DB Module 12, The Wisdom of Emptiness. So welcome to the class. And again, I want to thank you for taking time. I know some of you have jobs and work or whatever you do. It takes an effort to actually come to a class, so it just is a good thought, good feeling to see people actually attending the class. So thank you for that. And so what we typically start with, as you always know, that mentally, because if you want to do it on your own, that's fine, but at least let's mentally start with a nice pre-prostration in your mind. And you start typically from your head, and then between your eyes, throat, and chest, and you say, Namo Manju Shriye, Namo Su Shriye, Namo Tama Shriye, Soha, and then bring it up. Just do that 3 times in your mind. It's always good to start anything you do with your practice. It is respecting the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, which is what we call triple gem. It also humbles oneself. It also brings your attention to the teachings, and it develops good qualities, admiration for teachings, and based on your comfort level, obviously. And so it's just more of a respect to the teachings rather than bowing personally to someone or to something. A lot of people have a negative mindset for that, but this is not about bowing to something. It is simply showing humbleness, okay? So thank you for that. And what we want to do is bring our mind to the class. So we typically start with a breathing meditation, calm abiding meditation. So let's just kind of bring your attention to yourself, okay? If you're sitting on the floor, then you know the position of keeping your back straight, legs crossed. And if you're sitting on a chair, obviously you want to keep your feet on the floor, right? And so then the next thing you want to do is get your arms situated properly, okay? Held loosely on your lap, and you want to have your thumbs touch just like this. Your head is slightly tilted forward, not too much, just slightly. And your head, and then your jaw and mouth are relaxed, and your tongue is touching on the top behind the teeth, very relaxed, okay? And what you want to do is just relax yourself and bring your attention to your breath. And the why we choose breath? Breath is neutral. We all breathe, so there is no image in your mind. It is very relaxing, and all you want to do is kind of bring your focus onto your breath. And you can focus in two ways. You can feel the tingling sensation by your nose, or just looking at your stomach going in and out because of your exhaling and inhaling. That's where you want to keep your mind for a few seconds. If you find that your mind is beginning to wander, just gently, don't pay attention to the thought, bring it back to your breath. This helps with concentration also. Now that we are somewhat calmer and in presence, we'll set the motivation. It is also a small meditation. Okay, so just hear and just think about what I'm saying, and we'll do it together. The wind of the autumn and the soft, puffy clouds are moving, but the space stands still. I would like us to meditate right now, and we'll do a little bit of breathing practice at the same time, and then we'll just relax. So let your relaxed mind be like the space that is standing still, and the thoughts that arise in it, like all the energetic activity of the autumn outside. The reason for this is to get a perspective of thoughts as thoughts arise within your mind. Including the thought of I. That is, but one of the energetic goings on in the apparently space-like changeless essence. The breathing practice we will do is 9-round breathing practice. And what you do, you're going to exhale and inhale slowly from both nostrils. As you exhale and inhale, that is one. Then hold it for a second or two, then do it again, that would be two. And you do that 9 times. Okay? So please do that right now. When you get done, just leave the mind inside and relax and simply observe your thoughts. Simply watch them without any expectations. You don't have to analyze anything. Just relax and be aware. So as with meditation we just went through, determine to build on whatever insight you gained through this meditation until you reach the perfection of wisdom and compassion. And imagine how wonderful it would be to lead living beings from their misery into happiness by means of this attainment. you can bring your attention back to the class. Okay. It's just a quick review of what we've covered so far. And for those that have missed something or are just joining us, this gives you a good way to catch up on a few things. Of course, I cannot go into every detail, but at least it gives you an idea about what we have been talking about. Okay? So review so far. Okay. So what we first started out, obviously, class number one was basically introductions, and we saw videos, and I gave you a good introduction. Linda talked about the class and how you can find your links and so forth. So all those administrative and other things were taken care of in the first class, but then we really started to introduce the course of the wisdom of emptiness, okay? And it was very important to see the lineage. For anything we start, it's important to know where this is coming from. Who is it that is saying these things? So you can be confident that it is coming all the way from Buddha down. But it's good for you to check this out, because it's very obvious that we can go on Google and find 20 different things right now. Now, which one do you trust more? So you have to be a little discriminated in this sense. If you want to learn properly, then you go to what is recommended by the FBMT, by our teachers, by His Holiness, and so forth. So it's important to establish that lineage so you feel comfortable and confident about where these teachings are coming from. And it also gives you a good idea that they are following the footsteps of the master, the unbroken lineage. This is not something Hemant is making up. Okay? And in that case, if there is an opinion, I will tell you that this is how I think, or this is what I thought. And so you take it with a grain of salt. but it is, again, from doing a lot of reading and contemplating and coming to some understanding. Obviously, I cannot read every single word. So we have to paraphrase sometimes, but that's where it's coming from. Okay? So in the lineage, we went all the way straight to Shakyamuni Buddha. After all, this is the Buddhist program for Mahayana Buddhism to FBMT. However, the concept is applicable anywhere to anybody. But we have to establish Shakyamuni Buddha was the first one, which we call the turning of the wheels. The second turning of the wheel was the essence of emptiness that he did Heart Sutra. So we went there. We also talked about great Indian pundits like Nagarjuna, Lama Tsongkhapa. We talked about how Buddha's 84,000 teachings were organized into three different baskets, one for the discipline, one for the discourses, and one for the knowledge sake. And then you could further elaborate and say, well, Buddha was... There's so many people visiting Buddha to learn. So he taught according to the capacity of the person. And you can imagine that if you were to talk emptiness to a kindergarten, that would not last more than 5 minutes, right? So you need to know that different people from villages to kings to monks to highly learned yogis came to learn from Buddha. So he categorized his teachings for the universal vehicle versus the individual vehicle, commonly known as the Hinayana path or the Mahayana path. And if you're not familiar, you can look it up. That Hinayana path mostly started to go out of India to Thailand and Sri Lanka in that direction, in Indonesia, towards the south side, whereas the Mahayana path went more towards the north of Tibet and China and so forth, just for perspective. And one is, they're both important and very important. One should not think one is better than the other. Ultimately, we have to make that determination. And the differences are this. Whereas individual path talks about individual liberation from this birth and rebirth and death cycle. Whereas Mahayana path is more conducive to the family of compassion, where we think it is the highest level. You need to be enlightened first in order to then be able to help others. That is the Mahayana path, okay? So that's how you should think, but you first need to be liberated yourself also, so it's always important to know all the teachings properly and put it in perspective. One is not necessarily not good, and one is good, and all that. We need all of that. but Mahayana kind of takes care of everything into a study program. We have Lambrim, which gives you step by step by step all the way to enlightenment, right? So that also DB classes are structured in this way, so you get a taste at least the fundamental levels of all the major topics you need to be familiar with. And then you can obviously concentrate on your own to where you need to get better at something. So having said that, we talked about that. And then I introduced you a little bit to, and of course, while talking about the individual vehicle, I also briefly gave you an introduction that when Buddha came out of his meditation and was enlightened or awakened, he realized why people cycle through all the time. This, why do they come back to samsara? And then we talked about the 12 links of dependent origination and how it begins with just a simple thing like ignorance, and then how it moves all the way down to death and rebirth again, and we cycle back and back again and again and again. He realized that there is a way out of it, right? And that's where we come in. And so we'll touch upon those 12 links briefly again as I'm progressing towards my overview. The next thing we talked about was a quick introduction to the Heart Sutra. This Paramita Sutras, so-called the Wisdom Sutras, there are plenty, quite a few of those, but the main essence, if you were to say, there are some texts on it and some other sutras, like the Diamond Sutra and all that, but the main one, if you were to talk about the wisdom of emptiness, is the Heart Sutra. And so we introduced that and how all these 10,000 writings could be put into 8,000 down to few texts, but also can be said in a simple mantra called Sayatha Gate Gate Paragate Parasamagate Bodhisoha. So anyways, it's a shorter way of realizing what we are talking about once you have some knowledge in it. So we talked about that. I also went into Master Nagarjuna, why this was important, because he is the great champion of the middle way, the school that we follow. And why? There were already existing schools, and the thought of this wisdom of emptiness existed in different views. There were all kind of challenges. Some people thought it is everything is mine. Some people would say, no, everything is out there. It is not. So there were a lot of these schools existing. I'm just saying that, but just know that the Nagarjuna brought it together in a very nice way, and he debated, and finally it is an accepted view that we follow, including His Holiness. Okay? So that's an important thing. And a little story about Nagarjuna, how he was young and he was going to die. However, his parents did a lot of meritorious work, and then he joined the Nalanda University, where a lot of our teachings come from. And then from Nalanda University, he was even appointed an abbot, and he was the one who was given the responsibility or was very closest to the wisdom of emptiness. And there's a whole legend how he went to Kathmandu and went down underground and got this wisdom of all the emptiness sutras and teachings, and he put it together. So that was the main thing about Nagarjuna. So this is the lineage we follow. How do you substantiate that this is the way we should follow? Our lineage master, Lama Tsongkhapa, who is our lineage guru or teacher, he was a very highly attained yogi, as you would know. He wrote the Lambrim, the treatise of the path, the stages to the path, the three volume. And he, in his discussion or consultation with Manjushri, he was able to have conversations with Manjushri, and he asked Manjushri, if I were to talk about this wisdom of emptiness, who should I follow? And the clear-cut answer was Nagarjuna. And then he asked, if there were commentaries on these teachings, who should we follow? He said, Chandrakirti. So these two names are important, the Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti. Okay? So obviously, Lama Tsongkhapa is the founder of the Gelug school, and he certainly said he relied on the teachings of Nagarjuna. And so it's important for us to know the lineage, and we should understand this. That does not preclude you from learning. There is another program after this DB at a higher level. It's called the Basic Program, and it talks about the tenets of the schools that existed who viewed this and debated this very, very poignantly. And I think if you are interested to learn more about it, you can certainly study those things. And it's taught by FPMC also. That gives you very technical knowledge. If you really are so prone to learn, tell me why and how we come to these conclusions. We're going to go today through some logic of how this all of these thoughts came about. Okay? So anyway, if I were to ask you right now, Lama Tsongkhapa said that, you know, Buddhas come from bodhisattvas. Okay, so we can say that very easily, and that's an assumption that everybody knows what is a bodhisattva. So can somebody just take a stab and tell me what's a bodhisattva and what do they possess, basically?
You guys feel free to unmute yourself and answer Hemet's questions about a bodhisattva.
I think it's just the bodhisattva is someone who's dedicated to helping other people along their path, and that's their purpose in life.
Very well said. Bodhisattvas are one who possess bodhicitta. So now this is another word. Please talk about it as if it was a normal word, bodhicitta. You must develop bodhicitta. So what is bodhicitta? Anyone, take a stab at it. It's not, we can always really talk it out if you have an idea. What is a bodhicitta? Dinesh, what do you think?
Let's see. I think the act of being compassionate, the heart of one who's compassionate.
Okay, so that's right on the money. So let me tell you how it is defined, or in the glossary of Rama Yeshe, properly said, you would say it's a principal consciousness that combines the two factors, wishing to free all beings from suffering and wishing to attain enlightenment in order to achieve that. So they are so yearning to be enlightened so they can come and help others. So you're right, it is on the path of compassion, but it takes it even further a little bit, right? So it's a good thing to know that. So when you're reading and says, if when somebody says, I need to develop compassion, I need to develop bodhicitta, so you can know it's a principal consciousness that combines the two factors, wishing to free all from suffering. So as you're living today, you can be a compassionate and kind person. That's a given. And then wishing to attain enlightenment. So you want to get enlightened. The path of becoming a bodhisattva and moving all the way up to get enlightened in order to achieve that function to help others. Okay? So it's a good thing to know. Nothing major, no quiz. It's just a good to talk it out. Sometimes, a lot of times I find myself as I am reading this or preparing for the class, I know it in here, but when you actually verbalize it, it comes out different. It does not connect things sometimes. So it's good to sometimes talk like that. It's good for you. Okay? And so the obstacle to any liberation, any antidote to the obstacles to the liberation is the direct realization of emptiness. And you should always think that I must realize emptiness no matter how long it takes and think I can do it. It is within my grasp. Okay? It's one thing to have intellectual knowledge, which is a good thing, nothing wrong, but we must develop this yearning and a sincere wish to be liberated. It's, I always, in a small analogy, in a very smaller way, is if you're looking very, you really want this job, would it be wise to know what it's all about? Who you're working for? Where you're going to go? Will it make you happy? Will it be okay job? Can you do it? You go through this process. You even create a resume. You want to go through interview. Well, if you want to get enlightened, you should think in your mind, what tools do I need to get enlightened? And thereby also understand, what is it to become a Buddha? How can I be one? So they have that yearning. That's the main thing. Then in session two, we covered the three principal aspects of the path. And if you don't know too much about Buddhism, if you were to concentrate on these three things, you will learn a lot about what are the main three, if you were to take the real nectar out of everything. Okay? You all know human rebirth is, human life is very precious. We know death cycle, everything is impermanent. We know different types of suffering. We go through all this. But the three nuggets out of this, one is renunciation. So you need to have that feeling you want to get enlightened and you don't want to come back in this rebirth and death cycle again and again and again. So you must have that feeling for developing yourself. It is not, when we say renunciation, it's not to say leave your house and put a little cap on and sit somewhere in the corner. That is not anybody saying you live normal life, but you must have an internal yearning to renunciate to so that you can move forward. Number two is to have bodhicitta, as in our Mahayana practice, very important that you don't think of I and me all the time. You want to be able to help others. They have been your mother sentient beings. If you had countless births, you have been in many places at many times and somebody has helped you. You can even look today, just put an apple in front of you and see how this apple came to in your hand, and you'll see how many people work behind the scenes for that apple to be in your hand. Same way, many people, your mother, father, and so we call them mother sentient beings that helped us. So that is number two. And the last thing is emptiness, understanding how things exist and why it's important. It cuts the root of ignorance. When it cuts the root of ignorance, you liberate yourself from this cyclic birth and death cycle. And with bodhicitta combined, now you are preparing yourself to become a Buddha. You are on the path, correct? So those three principal aspects of the path are very important. According to Manjushri tells Lama Tsongkhapa, you may master renunciation and wish to achieve supreme enlightenment, but unless you have the wisdom perceiving reality, you cannot cut the root of cyclic existence, make efforts in ways than to perceive interdependence. And we define some of these words. Any questions so far? So this is what we just went through, lineage, Nagarjuna, principles, aspects of the path, seeing no antidote to obstacle is realizing emptiness. And so the next thing I'm going to show you, I don't have that. Let's see. I may have it in the words here. So 12 links. I'm just going to briefly mention them. And what Buddha realized is that the reason people come back, it starts from the ignorance. And in a linear fashion, it would say then you develop actions. And then from actions, you develop consciousnesses. From there comes the name and form. And from name and form, the six senses develop. Then you start developing contacts. And from context, you develop feeling. And from feeling, you develop craving. And from craving, you develop grasping at things. I like it. I don't like it. This is better than that. And then that develops who you become. This is becomes your nature then. And then again, you go through the death cycle. You may carry some of these tendencies with you due to your karma or karmic seeds. And guess what? You're back in the cycle with those tendencies again. And that is this is a very brief way. And Karen, I promise you, I will cover in details of how these 12 links work. And I've been looking at it, but we'll have some time together and I will spend a little time to at least talk it out with you. Okay. So here's another thing I wanted to let you know what Nagarjuna said. You can read it. Okay. These were the 12 links. I was reminded that I was not moving my slides properly. So I wanted to make sure I do. So those were the 12 links. And if you remember, we went through this beautiful tanka last class, and this gives you an idea of what this is all about. And again, just to briefly explain to you, the centerpiece is, you see three animals there. Anyways, to keep it on the short side, it represents the three poisons, and it starts from ignorance, the pig, which is represented as ignorance, attachment, and aversion. Those are the three poisons. Ignorance, attachment, and aversions. And the other two are also part of the ignorance. And from there, you have the second layer, second circle. You see the white and the black, and that's karma. Good karma, bad karma. And then depending on your actions, these are the six realms on top of them. So the top three show you the higher realms, human rebirth, deva form, and they call it the asura form and all that. And the bottoms are the hellish realms or ghost realms or preta realms, whatever you want to call it. But they're the bad realms, what we call it. We will say in simple English. And the outer circle talks about the 12 links, the links that we just talked about. So that keeps us in circle, right? And the fierce figure that's holding this circular piece, okay, represents the impermanence, okay? And it shows how we are in the claws of this cyclic samsara, right? And then the moon on the left represents the liberation of cyclic existence. And on the right, on the top, you see Buddha pointing at the moon, and it represents him saying, there is a path, and liberation is possible, and he shows the path. Okay? So it's a great depiction of what we've been talking about. How do we relate this to emptiness? Always, when you are learning about emptiness, we don't want to get a myopic view of the charts and tankas and the 12 links and lose the picture. How does it relate to emptiness? And emptiness, we said, is not able to see the reality the way it is, ultimately how things exist. We are not able to see that because we have ignorance for eons. We've been going through this cycle again and again and again, and our tendencies have clouded the very fundamental thing, how things exist. And because of that, we have attachments and parts and qualities and exaggerations, and the upsetness starts, and I like it, and he does not, she does not respect me, and the ego gets hurt. And but once you find out how we truly exist, then you have taken the root of that ignorance out, therefore realizing the nature of reality, which is emptiness. So whenever you're going through all of these things, keep this in mind, okay, at all times. Okay, I'm not going to go through that. We went through the heart of the perfection of the Wisdom Sutra, Heart Sutra, the most important piece. I would suggest to you, after you go through your readings, I'm hoping that you are reading, you take some time to really, really read this and understand it. You may have to read it many times. And if you truly want to understand emptiness properly, obviously readings and interpretations are important. All the teachings are important, but this will take you home. Okay? So please try to understand what is meant by these words. That's some, and I think, Linda, you posted that commentary I had asked you last time. It goes into much more detail. It's actually from the basic class that I had. And it was a little advanced, but it was able to explain when somebody says form is empty, emptiness is form. It will tell you what do they mean by that. So it helps you, okay? And this is just I have the slide, so I left it in there. This is the mantra tayata om gate gate, para gate para samgate bodhi soha. Soha or swaha. Swaha is Sanskrit. Soha is more of a Tibetan word. Okay? So then the next thing we talk about ignorance so many ways. And so I said, we thought about at least going through a little bit of what is ignorance. And of course, that is the root of cyclic existence and is not mere lack of knowledge. So we use in English the word ignorance all the time. I'm ignorant of chemistry. I'm ignorant of algebra. That is not the ignorance we are talking about. This is the active misconceptions about the way things exist, period. Active misconception daily on everything. This is not one particular thing that we are talking about. It is natural to apprehend things the way they exist. That's according to Dharmakirti. Dharmakirti, and I'll have a little more about him, he was an epistemologist, or the one that looks at logic. And he also gives validity to things. You have to go through this process of logic to come to a valid understanding of things. Anyways, he provided this information. He also suggested that many misconceptions we have are due to superficial causes sometimes. External conditions, for example. You can, for example, if you see a bush moving sometimes and you may think it's a person. Or you're in a desert and you see a mirage and you see the water, but it's not there. So you sometimes have misconceptions like that. You could also have an internal conditions where your sense faculties are failing you, right? And then you could also misinterpret things or be ignorant of things. You know, people who have hepatitis or jaundice can probably see everything yellow and think the world is yellow, but it's not. The world is not yellow. It is a disease state. And let's take it even further, strong emotions. How clouded we get when we are angry. Just think about when you create that your ego is rising, you don't like something or you like something too much or whatever, you create this anger in you because now you don't like what you are seeing or what you want to see, and then you create this anger. Now you're losing all your faculties to think even correctly. At some point, the hatred gets so bad that you're even willing to hurt or kill somebody. And we talked about that a little bit. And you can see this happens to so many people. We see this on the TV sometimes, you know. But this is why, because they don't understand what reality is. And it's just they get into this completely ignorant view. Okay? He briefly talked about personal identity. And what we are talking about is how we cling very strongly to our identities of who we are. But who? And then the question is, who are we really? This is not about I mentioned last class, it's not about taking your license out and saying, I'm Hemant, and I have a family, I have two kids. We all have that narrative when somebody says, please introduce yourself. Oh, I've been coming to Kalampa Center for 6 years. I just started. I have a family. I live alone. And this is where I live. Like, we all say that story. But now go a little deeper. If somebody were to tell you, who are you? What makes you? What will come up is what we're talking about. And what this is trying to say is the Buddha recommended that we habituate ourselves with virtue. And why? Because if you have wrong views, angry mind, or ignorant view, guess what you're familiar with? Those views and that mind. That's what your identity is. At the end of the day, if you're mulling all these things in your head all the time, this permanent roommate, I call it, the chatter mind, is always looking at things that you are familiar with. That's what makes you, you. That creates your personality, your identity. And guess what? When there is a fear of death and you're close to that point in time in life, what do you think is going to come to your mind? Things that you're familiar with. You're not going to say, my license says I am registered here and my name is this. What you're going to cling on to is what you're familiar with, what you're attracted to. And that's why Buddha says we need to habituate ourselves and identify ourselves with virtuous people. Okay, give me 1 second. Okay, just one more thing I wanted. I was looking for my notes here. The person who's developed the syllabus, Thupten Pende, he mentions this, and I'd like to say this. It's a good thing for your mind. He says, definitely there is fear of not knowing what's going to become of you, where you're going to go. So a skillful practitioner, even if they haven't achieved liberative wisdom, acquire the confidence that they will take good rebirth by means of all the merit they have accumulated. They don't have any doubt about happiness they will enjoy. They generate the thought of refuge at the time of death. So if you practice daily, or you start to develop this yearning to go in the Bodhisattva's path to become a Buddha, you know, you develop this and you create that identity. This is what you want. This is who you are. And you work on it, work on it, work on it, till you feel comfortable and confident that that comes to your mind. And that's what goes with you. And guess what? If you go with that thought, you know it's going to be in a positive direction, or at least you will be in a human birth with those tendencies. How wonderful. Okay? So that's your personal identity. So be mindful of that. Let's talk about some definitions. Conventional or relative truth. Okay? What is true to the valid conventional consciousness? It is also called concealer truth or all of obscuring truth, because although true on one level, it obscures the ultimate nature of things. This is something you should think about. When we call conventions, we'll go into it in a little more detail today, and we'll go as far as we can go, and if not, we'll continue. But you'll look at these things, and you'll see how this works. And the ultimate truth, when we keep talking about ultimate truth, is the understanding of ultimate nature of reality, that the things are empty of true existence, and we'll go through that. Okay? And then we always see the two wings. You need the two wings to fly, method and wisdom. So I thought it was important to see that emotional or the compassionate side, the development of loving kindness, compassion, and bodhicitta, and supports the wisdom realizing emptiness. That's the method. So as you are in doing things on a daily basis, you can develop the method while learning and understanding what the wisdom is, the logical, more cerebral side, the wisdom realizing emptiness, which frees us from the cyclic existence. So with those two things in hand, you are definitely on the train. Right? Okay? So if I were to ask you a question, what is ignorance? You can answer it this way. Literally not seeing that which exists or the way in which things exist. There are basically two kinds, ignorance of karma, ignorance of ultimate truth. Ignorance is a fundamental delusion from which all others spring and is the first of the 12 links of dependent origination, which you should know that. Everything starts from that. Even so, that picture, the sankha, starts from ignorance. The more accurate our vision of reality is, the more informed our judgments will be, and therefore fewer mistakes, less suffering will occur. Okay? And I just threw in the prajna, so I probably have mistaken the word, that prajna is wisdom and paramita is perfection. Good to know, because that's what Heart Sutra is called, Prajna Paramita. I thought I'll throw in three more today. Okay, it's good for you to be, you will see when you do these readings, you will say, well, Dharmakriti was an epistemologist. Well, first of all, what the heck is it? You know, what credit does that carry? So I put down the theory of knowledge, especially with regards to its methods, validity, and scope. Epistemology is investigation of what distinguishes justified belief from opinion. In other words, logically looking at things. Okay. Dharmakriti was one. He was a 7th century Indian scholar and author of 7 treatises of the valid cognition, how we see things. He's one of the 6 great Indian scholars known as the 6 ornaments. So this were, a lot of these were probably Nalanda teachers, and a lot of commentaries of Buddha's teachings, sorry is the word, that they were the ones who translated that and put them into some sort of an organized way for all of us. So they're considered the 6 ornaments, okay? And no need to remember the names. If there were 2 in there, I would say at least I know 2 or 3. Nagarjuna is very good. Aryadeva and Nagarjuna work together. And then, of course, so sorry, and Chandrakriti you mentioned, but he was more of a commentator. And so these are the ones that we should be familiar with. And Dharmakriti is here. So just to know Nagarjuna, Aryadeva, Dharmakriti. So when you read these things, you don't go, your mind doesn't go, who the heck are these people? It just gives you a good perspective, okay? Good to know, just for knowledge sake. Okay, now we're getting into some stuff here. So we're going to start with the 4-point analysis, and I'm going to spend a little time on talking about the first point a lot, then the second point a little bit, and then you'll see the other 2 points are mechanical. It's like if you don't find it in A and if you don't find it in B, then it must be C or D. So it kind of repeats itself. Is one is findable, one is not findable. So it's a way to logically look at things. And we need to do that to completely have confidence that what we're seeing is correctly or not. Okay? So let's talk about the first point analysis. And what are the 4-point analysis? Let's first talk about that. First, we're identifying the person as it is misconceived by ignorance. So we talked about ignorance is what fools us, right? It does not let us see the reality. And so we think that we are this person, I. And just like everything externally we misconstrue to be real and inheriting existence, we also feel very strongly that something in me that is real, very organic, inherent, concrete. So we're going to look for that. Okay, simply as that. Don't even make judgments from anything else. Then we have to decide if this person truly existed the way it is misconceived, then it must be findable. If you think this person truly is there, it must be findable. And then we say, okay, you've seen all the examples. It's not my head, it's not my eyes, it might not be my toes. But basically any intelligent person would say, oh, no, no, no. It's this package. This mind, body, when you pull it together, that's I. We will go to that next level because we know that's how we think, right? We don't say my ear is not I, my eye is not I. We can talk like that. But when you have common sense in your back of your mind, you will say, no, 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 no. It's this package, this me, this my mind, my body, all that is I. So we're going to look for that in relation to body-mind complex. And if it is not there, it must be independently of that complex. If that I is not existing in that complex, it must be somewhere else. Then the third and fourth are pretty easy, proving that such a person is not findable in relationship to the body-mind complex. And then last one is proving that such a person is not findable independent of the body-mind complex. So it kind of covers the first two points in a just a very easy, logical way. So these are the four points. Okay, and I'll be very upfront with you. Even when I talk to Geshe La, before every class, I talk to Geshe La. And, you know, and he says, four-point analysis. Hemant, four-point analysis. So it's important that we see this, and I will also tell you that when you go through this, there are words in the way logic is written. Not everybody gets it the very first time. Okay, because the way it is written sometimes, by the time you mull it and think it over, I'm moving on to something different. So don't get discouraged by anything. And maybe for you it may be easy. Maybe it comes across very easily. But you need to really understand this. If this meditation is available in many places, you can find it and you can read through it. Okay? So let's start with that. So we have to decide that. So let's see, I can go. So first point is identification of what is to be refuted or negated. Okay, so let me see if my slide shows that. Nope, we have examples. I'm going to go through it. Let me go through mine. Okay, what is going on here? I have no idea. Give me 1 second, please. I'm sorry, but it is not going to the right slides. Give me 1 second. I'm going back. There it is. I got it. Found it. It automatically does that sometimes. All right. So let's take a look at it. So the person that we want to find, first we have to identify the person, okay, and as it is misconceived by ignorance. And we'll call that a truly existent person. Let's just give it a name right now, truly existent person. And there are many terms to refer to this fabricated person. Dharmakriti, which we just talked about, says that reality is a characteristic of only those things that are intrinsically able to produce effect. Make sense? So again, says reality is a characteristic of only those things that are intrinsically able to produce effects, able to do something, function a certain way. Okay? He used the definition because he observed that people are interested in what a thing can do. Now, what can this thing do for me? What this computer can do for me? What that car can do for me? He look at things that way. When what mattered the most to the people are events either helpful or harmful. And then people obviously go towards things that are helpful to be happy. Right? That's what we do. But when people examine whether a thing is able to function as claimed, they still cannot really conclude as it is real or not, you know, and there is no real assurance yet. you have to really feel that this is real for me. So we're going to walk through that thinking a little bit. Okay. So let's take an example. I'll go through this example. So we're going to walk through this really nice. I have many examples, and we're going to take a look at this example. So candle flame. So this is more, and please hang in there, because when I go through some of these examples, your mind will argue in the back of your mind, because we are not used to seeing things in a logical way. We are so used to placing our mind to see this and say, that's it. That's real. I can touch it. I can feel it. Oh, so we want to kind of investigate that. So this is why we give you this example. So let's take a look at candle flame for our logic. According to Dharmakriti, reality and true existence are equivalent. So reality and true existence are similar. Furthermore, he says that the two existent things are unique in terms of time and space. What does he mean by that? So if something exists in one place at one time, because when they function to produce an effect. In other words, if you take a candle flame, that's a better way to say it. If you take a candle flame, it's not another candle flame. It is that candle flame. Nor is it anything other than what it is. It is just a candle flame. Now let's take it logically. The flame of this moment is not the same flame of the previous moment. Can we get that? When you see the flame of this moment, it is not the flame of the previous moment. It is this flame. Why? Because the flame of the previous moment created this effect of this flame, and then it ceased. And now this flame exists. This will do its that job, and another moment of that flame is there. Make sense? So far, not too complex. So that is one of way of seeing things logically. So what we are doing here is creating a fundamental, laying the ground to start to think. So when we start to use these words, logic words, it doesn't confuse us. So all you right now need to know that how things, what we see, for example, take the logic of the flame, that what you see right now is that's what it is. It's not previous moment. And it exists uniquely in that time and space. That's all we need to know. Now here's the infamous cup. This is where we go and do a lot of talking. So I'll call this a cup in my hand right now, but it's a glass actually. I should have gotten a cup. So the cup exists in one place at one time. So it exists and can be characterized as being able to hold water. So when I use the word glass or cup in general, use the word general, what comes to your mind? This cup or cup in general? Now, let's find that cup in general. Is it in my cupboard? It is in your house? It is somewhere in Thailand? Cups are everywhere. But I can drink water out of this one. Can you drink water out of that cup? Those cups? Right? So it is just a thought. That cup, when something comes to our mind, it's a thought. You ascribe a name to it. Right? So, of course, my wife is very generous and brought me a cup, just so I can talk about a cup. So according to Dharmakriti, the generalized cup, the cupness, is a conceptually fabricated quality that is represented by individual cups. In other words, we can think of cup and a handle and so many different styles and all that. We kind of understand. It's a convention. It's an agreement between us to communicate. It's just a thought. It's an idea. So when I say cup, Danish, you, Linda, you, Sandra, you all know, Alex, that this is what we are talking about. So it's just a thought, but it's not real. It is just a thought with a name, and we designate that name. If somebody from outside has never seen a cup, bring somebody from Amazon Tribes and say, hey, can you pass me that cup? He's going to look at you like, what are you talking about? He's not going to know that cup. So convention. So this is how you go logically. So Western philosophies call this universals. When we talk about general things that are not there in front of you, real, then they call them universals. Okay? And they are not unique in time and space. because you don't know. When I say a cup, I have cups. You cannot know what I'm talking about. You just have an idea that I was talking about this thing that looks like this, but you don't know which cup I'm talking about. So that's a thought. So universals are essential to language. And we can use the same term. If you don't have this conventionality, we would have to name every cup something different. Right? So we have to have a convention to communicate. This is a simple, really statement that we need language to communicate with each other. But the logic says that we bring a thought up and we think it's all real. So just keep it there right now. Okay? So anyway, so although the universal cup is everywhere, in sense, it is nowhere. And so universals are just creation of thought and they do not truly exist. So the cup has the emptiness of the cupness. There is no cup. Cup. Now we are not talking about this cup yet. We're just saying when I bring the thought cup, okay, we'll take another example. This is a much easier one because you will already know in your mind what it is. So is everybody familiar with Harry Potter? Most of us are familiar with Harry Potter, right? Okay. It's the creation of name and thought, correct? If you know about him, you know he lives in this beautiful place, number 4, private drive, somewhere in Midlands in England. Okay? He sounds like he performs a function. But in his own right, there is no essence of Harry Potter. You can see him. You can visualize him. He exists in your thought. You can see all of those things. But we know that it's pure conceptual and it's nothing. He does not exist. This one is easy because you can say it's a fiction. Somebody wrote it. The author gave him life. But the point is how we see. Some word comes up, we can visualize, create an image. And I bet you not all of us have the same image. Probably have different images of the same idea. Okay? So again, according to Dharmakriti, for something to be true, for something to be real, its essence must be objectively established and not artificially ascribed by words and thoughts. And it must have the ability to perform functions. Right? So we already know that. So that was the second example. Now back to the cup again. We're going to take it a little further. Okay, it's a physical object occupying space, right here. So let's try to identify the real object. From a universal quality, artificially ascribed, like the cup or the cupness or my car or the cardness, we can know that that's a thought and a language. So we talk about this cup now. What is occupying the space here? It is a unitary, homogeneous thing that occupies this space, or let's take it further. Are these discrete particles within the cup? This cup is a ceramic clay cup. It is made up of many, many small particles. Those particles have sub-level particles. And at some point, we used to think even atoms are the building block. But since then, they've found out photons and protons and electrons and so forth. And now they've even gone further to partless particles like neutrinos and quarks and so many things. The fact is, now we have to think about it. Is it the particle or is it the cup? What's holding the water? So you might say, Hemant, come on, man, it's both. It's the particles. The collective appearance of this thing put together that makes up this cup. That's what we would say. Right? And again, just a pause. We are thinking about, and we talk about four-point analysis, where I is body-mind complex. You have to kind of start to see how logically they are coming to some of these examples, and through examples lead you into understanding how things are seen, thought of, and exist or do not exist the way we think they exist. So they want to open your mind up a little bit, okay? So we have a question, what is real here, cup or the clay particles? You might say both. And it implies then that the cup is identical to the particles. And you say it's the cup and it's kind of both. It sort of implies that this cup and particles are kind of the same thing. Right? So you're putting cup into the particles and particles onto the cup. You kind of mix-mashing. you might even take it further and think it's permanent. It's there. It's going to last forever, right? But there's already small changes going on at atomic level, and this may just be integrated at some point even. So even those changes are going on, which goes to say it is an impermanent, and those particles can be broken down further and further and further. So you can see that, relatively speaking, conceptually, you can say this cup exists and I can drink water out of it. However, when you look at the ultimate nature of the cup, it is a mere label, and that the cup does not exist from its own side. There is no cup in this cupness. There's no cupness in this cup, I should say. However, conventionally, we call this a cup. Relatively, we can put the particles, the name, the thought, and saying, yes, I can pour water and drink of it, so it exists. So this is how things have to be seen, that while things appear to exist, when you analyze it deeply, you find out that they don't exist from their own side, and that goes to show, and the question may come up, and I will talk to you later about how to see things, because immediately your mind goes to say, if nothing truly exists the way they did, then what the heck exists? This is where the mind will go. And we have to talk about that, and I will bring that up. But at least know that things do exist relatively. We perceive things. I feel hungry. I feel the pain. So something exists. But when you look at each of the event or object carefully by itself, you find out that it does not exist independently. It is interdependent. See how now this is coming together. You look at this entire phenomena, how things are interdependent on each other. You should open up your mind right now. We are all connected in some way or form. It's an amazing thinking how this phenomena, there is no labels, no thoughts. It is what it is. We, for convention purposes, our consciousness has to function. So we are left with a mere thought that how things are, but we exaggerate everything. So that's the problem. So let's go further, okay? Let's take a closer look a little bit even further. So according to Dharmakirti, the cup we think of does not truly exist. We mistakenly apprehend it as if it does. Of course, this cup I'm holding, he says, is not totally unreal. There's something there. It's just how we, when you look at it, relatively speaking, in other words, it's parts, all of this coming together, particles put together, the clay, and we put these things together, and we put a name on it, cup. A picture of this cup comes up, and I can drink water out of it. When I analyze this deeply, you can start to fall apart a little bit. So you have to consistently be between these two thought patterns, how relatively things exist, they do exist. However, when you analyze it carefully, they don't exist on their own inherently. That's all. And that's why we call it the middle way. If you get too concrete, then there is no change. If you get nothingness, then there's zero. There's nothing to talk about. So middle way. Things are existing relatively. However, when you analyze each individual thing, you find that they don't exist from their own side. So everything is dependent. Buddha, so if you've seen a Buddha story, he asked a charioteer, where is the chariot? He says, here, Buddha. And Buddha says, is it the wheel? Is it the hub? Is it the spoke? Is it the horse? Is it you? Where is? So he was trying to bring out that point again, that yes, there is something there. It functions like a chariot, but there is no inherent. It depends on all these parts. And then we call it chariot. So it functions that way. That's how we see things. Okay, so that's enough of that right now. So then there are other philosophers who assert that appearances are produced only in the mind. And therefore mind is real. Everything else is fake, not there. Well, our teachers take them further to task. And they say Chandrakirti and Shantideva assert that this is not a solution to the problem what causes appearances. It only transfers the problem to the mind. However, if you look at the mind, it's also a composite of continuum of thoughts. As a previous moment creates an effect, another moment will come. And you can go back and back and back. There's nothing concrete about it. It just processes thoughts. You need to know and process his thoughts. There's nothing real about it from its own side. Okay? So nothing is not the answer, how, as it does not explain what we perceive. So relatively, things exist. Things exist how we perceive. It's just that we have to be very mindful that how we exaggerate everything because of that ignorance, because we don't see. We don't see this. We give a concrete life. You, me, I, she, it, I love it, I hate it, this is horrible, this is terrible, this is wonderful, I love it. We go on exaggerating so many qualities onto things. Whereas if you just think very in a normal way, you will see how. If somebody, I have some other examples, I think I need to go to the examples which will give you a better picture, because this can get very confusing sometimes. So let's, the easy way to remember is, let's take a look at the rainbow. You see a rainbow, don't we? Sometimes we've all seen a rainbow. There it is. It's a rainbow, beautiful color. How wonderful it looks. However, we don't look at it and say, oh, that is just a visual consciousness, and it's a mere appearance of interaction of light and moisture. We don't see it that way, right? We don't talk like that. If you were to look at it carefully, you would know it's a mere light interacting with the moisture, and even that moisture has other dependencies, interdependencies for where that moisture is even generated from, and same thing about light and its reflection and the colors it produces. See? So think about how interdependent things are, but when it comes into view, we need conventionally agree that we'll call this a rainbow so that it exists. But when you look at it very carefully, it's not there from its own side. How things come to view, everything like this is that way. Everything is there. You, I see you, I see Linda, I see my room, I see my background, everything. However, if you really look at things, how we exist, you will find out. You're not going to find this essence that you're looking for, that you exist by yourself. Okay? We are interdependent. Okay? So that's one example. So things exist through thought. And every quality that acquire, like Harry Potter character, their qualities attributed by thought. Okay. Let's take another example at Kopan, Lama Zopa Rinpoche. Purposely is to bring this old-time hippie-type people who used to go to Nepal to tour for many other entertaining things would wind up at Kopan because it was a thing to do. And Lama Zopa Rinpoche would sometimes say something really crazy, totally crazy, and people would get upset. And he would ask, are you upset? And they would say, yeah, darn it, yes, I am. And then he would say, what part of this upsets you? My words? Or the alphabets? Maybe consonants? What's upsetting you? A, E, I, O, U? A, B, C, D, E, F, G? What is upsetting you? And then he would slowly convert that into saying, it is not my words. It is how you, in your mind, interpret those. You would slowly walk them through that, and people would be like, whoa. Right? And what happens to us, the same thing. If your boss or your friend calls you a thief or stupid, that concrete eye comes up so quickly, doesn't it? So we'll have to tear that apart a little bit so we can calm down a little bit. Right? So that's what it's all about. Anyway, and then one more example I have is about a tanka, and you know, two more examples. You know what a tanka is, right? Most of us know. Those are Tibetan pictures on brocade. It's in all over the Kadampa Center. That's a Tibetan name, tanka. Tankas are many places. But you don't find the tanka-ness in the tanka. Why? If I was to take that painting and put it in a wooden frame right now, would you call that a tanka? Nothing has changed except it's not on the brocade. And in Tibetan, tanka means a painting that can be scrolled. Can be rolled, scrolled, moved around. So if you take that, now put it in a frame. What is it now? Is it a painting? Is it just an art? What is it now? So there is no tanka in tanka-ness. But if it is given a name and a title and exists in the way we want an ideation of that, then we can call it a tanka. So again, a concept given by name and label. And we immediately know what it is. It's real. So we believe the mere creation of name and thought exists as a real object, independent of name and thought, the so-called concrete object as opposed to abstract object, right? So we have to have that feeling in it. One more example and then we'll move on. So let's look at our countries and boundaries. This was fun. I was going through these and I found these examples and I thought this was a funny one too. Okay, they seem so real. We know where Canada is. We know where Mexico is. We know where Europe is. Now show me the boundary, real boundary. The birds fly without visa all day long. They don't say I'm going to Canada. Right? The insects from Mexico come to Arizona all day long. They don't say, oh, this is a boundary. If the boundary truly existed, it would be in the earth, in the water, in the air, in the space. However, it is an idea made by us. We draw a map. We have all this kind of artwork and create a boundary with a line that says this is USA and that is Mexico. Again, what is it? It's a name given, name taught. But in our mind, I know I'm moving over to another country. This is different. This is a boundary. I'm no longer in North Carolina. I am in Virginia. See how we create this? Because it is natural. Linguistically, these things are a conventional truths. We have to do that to communicate with each other and manage things. So know there are two realities, relative or conventional reality and ultimate reality. It's just they are dependent on so many things. And conventionally things exist, but they don't exist inherently. That's all you need to know right now. Okay, so many examples there. They're very interesting. So before we go to the meditation, I have a couple of one or two more statements to make. That our journey is individual journey. Just know that nobody's coming with us. You're going to go on your own. You go into your own bardo. You're reborn by yourself. And therefore, only one, you can rely on yourself. There are no other authorities. There are no other protectors in that sense. So we develop this quality. So we survive by depending upon words and thoughts. We talked about conventional reality, words and thoughts. That's how we survive. Your thoughts is how you create your reality. Therefore, choose wisely. Think about that. We develop the qualities. We develop the lifestyle, everything we hope to have, the ability to think and express ourselves. Okay? But you can take that and convert that into a beautiful path. So all your view, thoughts, language, words, vocabulary, whatever you know as a conventional truth, you can use that to benefit you. Okay? So that's why it's in a positive way. So let's see, it's quarter after eight. I'm going to do this meditation and then maybe after this meditation, time permitting, we'll go further. If not, we'll continue in the next class with a little more details on those 4 points. So far, before we go into meditation, and hopefully this meditation will also give you some, solve some of the questions. But are you beginning to understand a little bit? Does everybody feel little bit of comfort in understanding how everything we create through thoughts and words and language conventionally, right?
We do have a couple of comments, Hemant. Dennis, who's joining us on YouTube from Canada, Cape Breton, says that he meditates on using the flame of a candle. And which would be helpful with emptiness and impermanence, as it's ever changing. And all of these examples were great. A couple of students have mentioned how all of them, you know, had something to them. They were great. And then another comment is, back when you were talking about the first example of the cup, someone commented, because cup is a concept only existing in our minds, that's why we have disagreements about whether a hot dog is a sandwich.
It is how you the agreement you make with others. Because if you were to come to me and call that a sandwich, I may challenge you because that's how I see it, right? So that's the whole idea.
Exactly. And I think, oh, and the last one, this is pertains to the meditation that I guess we're about to do. The student wants to know if during the meditation on emptiness, we are supposed to realize the ultimate reality of everything. Is that supposed to be revealed automatically when we meditate on emptiness, or is the realization of ultimate reality a separate practice?
Okay, there's a couple of points in there. Obviously, you need knowledge. That's number one. It requires reading, knowledge, and contemplation, because we have to fine-tune it. Even when you start to see some things, you have to question yourself, what is that thinking? Is it an idea of your own mind and you're creating an appearance? It has to be fine-tuned to the point where you truly see the phenomena as how it is. Okay? So it takes a lot of work. It takes even yogis long time to really have a direct vision. However, the starting point is like what we are doing. We are learning this concept, and it is very hard. Even Lama Zopa Rinpoche, if you did your reading, it says, it is very hard for eons. We've been practicing I, me. It doesn't go away that quickly. Even when you start to think, oh, I can see, you can get glimpses of this as we talk, because your mind is cognizing the logic in it. So you see glimpses, but to directly perceive how things exist, you need some work and meditation and contemplation. So the answer is both. You may need to study outside this, but when you do meditation, it allows you to really absorb this concept and see that the way I've been thinking all along, I'm beginning to see some aha moments to come out of it and saying, yes, this makes sense to me. I still do exist. However, I don't exist inherently because everything is interdependent, and how things come and go and all this, and I create a mirror image, and then I serve to help and do other good things. You got to bring all of those things, and then questions will come up. Why? Who said it? What if it's this way? And what if it is that way? All this is all valid. And unless and until you truly go through this four-point analysis and read more and look at it from different angles and come to terms with it and becomes part of your daily practice, it is not that you come on Sunday, you understand the concept, walk away, and now you can't see emptiness because, you know, it was a good class. To make it part of your habit is that daily telling this mind and this person that this is how everything is, and that's how I've been seeing things. You can neutralize and see both. Conventionally, things are fine, but you're not going to get into the drama. You're not going to take things too personally. Why? Because we are all interconnected, and those are mere words. Now, you can be intelligent and know that what that could do, but don't make things up. If you look at it very carefully, you can also not take things, create unnecessary stress, and not superimpose more than what it is. Okay? That doesn't mean your karma is not going to show you some good times and bad times. It is not going to say that as soon as you see emptiness, it takes time till you can get into that situation. So just let's go through this, but hopefully we will all realize it soon. Okay? So good, perfect timing. So let's do this meditation. You already all know the position you should be in. Sit comfortably, relax, open your mind up, take all the stuff out of your head and just listen in and kind of think about as we walk through these points. Think about these topics. Okay? So this is the meditation on I. Okay? I invite you to take a moment to put yourself in a comfortable position for meditation, paying special attention to your posture. Okay? And think, I am sitting here. I do not seem to be construct like Harry Potter. I am not fictional. I exist. I am real. I perform functions. Harry Potter performs functions too, but only because the author said so, not because he actually did so. Well, I perform functions. I speak, move around, cast a shadow, all of these things. I do it myself. I'm real. So now the next thing is, which body is sitting here or there? Whose body is sitting here? Is it your body that is sitting here and you think I am sitting here? Are you thinking about your body or someone else's body? Well, usually when a person thinks I am sitting here, they are referring to their own body. So then the question is, does your body belong to you? Why not? There are no slaves around here. It's your body. Well then, is it your body that's doing the sitting? Or are you doing the sitting? And are they identical? The body is certainly sitting. You are certainly sitting. Are these two sittings that are taking place or one sitting taking place? So there is only one sitting when you think I am sitting here. And even though the body is also sitting, it does not mean that there are two sittings. There is still only one sitting. So then, are you identical to your body? The meaning of identical is to be not different in any ways. Are you just your body? Do the expressions, I have a body, the body has a body, have exactly the same meaning to you? They do not, because you think of yourself differently from the way you think of your body. And yet, there is still only one sitting taking place, not two. If the I was a real object, then it would be either identical with the body, or there would have been two sittings going on. Perhaps there's a third possibility, namely that body is not sitting. Think of it. I am sitting, but my body is not sitting. Then you are really independent from your body. If that's the case, why do you bother even sitting? The only way you can have one sitting and two things doing it is if one or both of those things are creation of thought. It is simple. I have the thought I am sitting while the body is sitting. That's how it works. But is that how we feel when we think I am sitting here? Doesn't it feel a bit more than that? Don't we feel more concrete than an imaginary person invented by words in relation to the body's posture? Don't we feel a little bit different from that? Well, I'm not the sound I. I'm not even the thought I. The thought I does not have to sit after all. But when the sitting posture of the body in the thought I am sitting appear mixed or associated, we have indisputable activity being done by a person called I or me. When analyzed, if you take the sound I by itself, that's not me, nor is the thought of I me. The body is not me either. Put all of these components aside, and there is no me. There is no I whatsoever. Look right there, where you feel yourself the most, right here, touching your chest, then you can point to yourself and proclaim yourself loudly, here I am, sitting in this place right now. How quickly this fantasy is dismissed, like a bubble popping, when you consider how different the part of your chest covered by your pointing finger or hand is from who or what you think you are. Sometimes it feels hard as a stone right in the center of the chest, such as when someone calls us stupid. That sensation, however, does not require a solid object to be felt. If we believe in something strongly enough, our nervous system will accommodate that belief by functioning as if it were so. Our muscles will constrict as if grabbing hold of an object tightly. Even a mind exhibits all the physical strain as if the imaginary boulder he's carrying was real. Likewise, the muscles in our chest constrict around that imaginary self we believe to be real. We have an unfortunate habit of believing indiscriminately that objects exist as they appear. However, our mind is capable of generating appearances without any objective fact. People believe in the existence of unicorns, dragons, and other fantastic creatures only because they are described with words and drawings in the books. Although we can imagine such things, it doesn't mean that they are real. An object may appear as if its presence was made known by sheer force of it appearing to us, like a reflection appears in a mirror through the force of an object placed in front of it. However, an object may appear through subjective rather than objective causes. It may be creation of words and thought. We may, out of habit, believe that objects exist in their own right, because this is how they appear to us. But when analyzed, we discover that they never, ever existed in that way. Even not even an atom was ever really there. You can believe in a real self, and you can even give it a name. You can claim it the agent of all sorts of activities, provide it with a history, but it was never ever really there. The Buddha said the person, ourselves, never truly existed, not even a part of it, never ever was it really there as a concrete re-entity. As a creation of thought and speech, it has nominal existence, established by conventions, according to arbitrary but accepted rules of language. As such, it is there. It has all kinds of qualities. It performs functions that are conceptually attributed to it. But that self, that me, never appeared to you or anyone else through the force of its own existence. And that is the key, force of its own existence. When we appear, that appearance does not arise in the mirror of our mind through the force of a person in front of it. It appears by means of words and thoughts, like fictional character, such as Harry Potter. Our mind is a magician that makes fantasy appear as a reality. Can you bring your mind back to the class? Thank you so much. So the next class, we will actually, sorry, there's an echo going on somewhere. Oops, okay. The next class will actually go through these 4 points in a little more details, okay, just to break it apart a little bit. So please, guys, I wish we had 2 more minutes. Maybe I can read something real quick if you don't mind. Can you hang in there for a minute or two? Max, okay? I want to put people's mind to a little bit of ease in a certain way. So I'm going to go to my notes that I took today. And I'm going to go there. Into collections. Give me 1 second. Maybe I will introduce it next class a little bit. I had a really nice little write-up from Venerable Rene Fuse, and I wanted to share that with you. I can probably still do it if I have this. It's okay. I will talk to you next class. I think he puts that in a real good perspective. People will wonder then what really exists, and we keep on forgetting the fact that when we look at things conventionally, things exist in independence of each other, right, in independence of other things. So we must at least keep that in mind that, yes, when you go to the car and when you turn the key, it functions. So there's a car. However, if you were to take a look at the steering wheel, the car, you're not going to find a car nest in that car. But it is functional, so there is a car that you can drive. Similarly, we all have a mirror nature that visualizes these things in our mind, and it will function. So it's not like zero. There's a blank white wall. It's not like that. All these appearances in front of you, we are sitting in a class. It is, I can see you. We talk to each other. We hear the sound. Just remember that as you move through your life, when you meditate, just don't exaggerate or superimpose this concreteness that I solidly exist. This is solid. View everything from that view of ultimate reality and how things are interconnected. And you are just moving part of that. You are just part of that phenomena. And we have this mind that is evolved to the point within this phenomena that can do this wonderful thing like develop love, develop kindness. And we need that mind to take us towards the full experience of this. So this is a wonderful, that's why they say precious human rebirth. You have this opportunity to even think. We have a tremendous mind, a mind that sees what mind is thinking. Think about that. We can see in our mind what we are thinking. That's how powerful we are. So with that, we will cover the points 1, 2, and 4, which is in front of me right now. We will go through, we will determine the modes such as an I and all of those things with the 5 aggregates. The only thing I ask you is if you haven't read your readings, the next reading I want you to do is called The Non-Duality by Lama Yeshe. It's a very powerful reading. Please read it. So for this class today, you should have learned how to meditate on emptiness. And previous class, I had asked you to read this 4 or 5 pages. And you should have read those very simple pages, what is emptiness, seeking the I. Those are some very simple readings, 4 or 5 pages max. The non-duality has a few more pages. And then the last one we'll talk about next class. But if you read that, what we talked about today will make more sense. Okay? I'll close with that. I know we are a minute or two over 8:30. I don't want to take more time.
Thank you, Hemant.
Okay, I'll hang in here for a while if you want to talk to me.
Thank you,
Hemant.
Thank you, Hemant. Thank you, Hemant.
Bye, Dad.
Bye. Have a good night. Good night, Sandra. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hi, Suraj.
Rajesh, nice to meet you on Zoom.
You as well.
That's so neat that you can come to your dad's class. Yay!
And that's your son. Nice meeting you.
Suraj, yeah. Hi, Naga.
Hi, how are you? We met today in the Gampa.
Yeah, there's no way to make this entertaining. You know, it is what it is, and you got to really dig it and dig into this stuff.
I didn't sleep. I was meditating.
I hope it starts to make a little more sense slowly and steadily.